This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The taco. For 50 years, it's been a part of American culinary life. You can find it in school lunches and Michelin-starred restaurants. The taco even inspired this famous chihuahua.
Yo quiero Taco Bell.
A new book, Taco USA, How Mexican Food Conquered America, tracks the history of the taco, along with other Mexican imports such as chili, tamales, margaritas. Carolina Miranda took a ride with the book's author, Gustavo Arellano, to find out why this Mexican snack food looms so large in American bellies.
How are you doing today?
Very good, thank you. Yeah, can I get a Doritos Locos Taco Supreme, please?
Gustavo Arellano is a food writer and editor at the OC Weekly in Orange County, California. He is taking me on a 150-mile journey in search of the Taco Grail.
We're taking a taco trip through time, charting the evolution of the taco, specifically here in Southern California, but also on the bigger scale.
Our first stop is Cielito Lindo, a tiny family-run stand on Olvera Street, the historic center of Los Angeles.
These are four freshly made taquitos. They started our warehouse in Lincoln Heights, where we make our tortilla from fresh nixtamal, no preservatives.
That's co-owner Diana Guerrero Robertson. Since the 1930s, her restaurant has been famous for its rolled fried tacos, taquitos, covered in avocado sauce.
Then we hand-roll them with our steamed, seasoned beef that's the style of barbacoa. And our salsa is also made there, which is made with spices, chili, and avocado.
So this taquito that Cielito Lindo really introduced, people all over Southern California start copying it. The exact same way to fry it, the avocado salsa, everything.
Cielito Lindo's taquitos were so popular, they gained a following among Mexicans and non-Mexicans alike. The United States had discovered the taco. From L.A., Arellano takes me 60 miles east to San Bernardino. It's a horizontal place full of truck yards and train depots. It's from here that the taco eventually went national.
When you think of tacos, think of bells. When you think of bells, think of tacos.
Taco Bell was launched in an L.A. suburb in 1962 by Glenn Bell. Prior to that, he lived in San Bernardino, where he owned a burger stand and later a small chain called Taco Tia, Taco Bell's precursor.
If tacos had become popular in Texas first, before Southern California, I don't think tacos would have spread as far as they currently have, because where we're going in San Bernardino, this is the birthplace of the fast food industry. This is where McDonald's was born.
It was fast food, and Taco Bell specifically, that was instrumental in taking tacos beyond the Southwest. Today, the company has 6,500 locations in all 50 states and almost a dozen countries. They sell more than 2 billion tacos a year. Tom Wagner is a vice president for the company.
If you go more to the Midwest and in the Northeast, oftentimes, Taco Bell defines people's experiences with Mexican food. So even though we call ourselves Mexican-inspired, in much of the country, Taco Bell defines what Mexican food is.
The chain also helped make Mexican food palatable to a country that had historically regarded it with suspicion, according to Jeffrey Pilcher, a food historian at the University of Minnesota and author of the forthcoming Planet Taco, A Global History of Mexican Food.
Fascination with Mexican food. This is totally different. And yet it's seen as being dangerous. It's hot, obviously, but there's also this fear that it's contaminated. So really what I think Glenn Bell was successful in doing was in franchising and selling Mexican food to a mainstream audience, to, frankly, across the lines of segregation that still existed in 1950s California.
But where did the recipe for the Taco Bell taco come from? Arellano says he's figured it out, and the answer can be found in San Bernardino.
Here, we're at the intersection of Old Route 66, now called Mount Vernon, and 6th Street.
Here stands Mitla Cafe, a family diner that's been serving up Mexican food since 1937. Mitla's crunchy tacos are strangely familiar. Crispy, stuffed with ground beef, iceberg lettuce, and a pile of yellow cheese. Irene Montaño is the cafe's owner. Her in-laws started the business.
Glenn Bell had his hamburger stand across the street, and he used to come over here and talk to my father-in-law and ask him how to make tacos and how they did different things, but especially the tacos.
Meatless tacos may look like a Taco Bell taco, but they certainly don't taste like one.
I could tell, you know, eating this, you could tell why America fell in love with this type of taco so fast.
The tortilla is light and crisp. It dissolves the minute it hits the tongue.
It's the taco. If Cielito Lindo's little taquito is like the ancestor of what we know now as taco, this was the taco, the taco that launched 1,000 tacos.
Put a smile on your face.
Tacos have become so American, they sometimes barely seem Mexican.
Mexican food is as American as nachos. You find nachos all over ballparks in the United States. It's just part of the cuisine at large.
There are now spaghetti tacos, Korean tacos, and broccoli pine nut tacos. The taco, it seems, is right up there with hot dogs and apple pie. For NPR News, I'm Carolina Miranda.
Clean, safe food. It seems like growing it would be good for the environment. But farmers here in California are proving that it can be just the opposite. Much of the spinach and lettuce Americans eat comes from California. And a deadly outbreak of E. coli a few years ago involving spinach put many farmers on a single-minded focus on food safety, which in turn has hurt wildlife. Included streams and rivers. NPR's Dan Charles made a trip to where the spinach is grown to explain why.
I'm taking a little tour of the Salinas Valley on California's central coast with Daniel Mountjoy, an ecologist.
I love the drive down through here.
There are mountains to the east and the west, but the valley, miles wide, is as flat as high-tech field leveling equipment could make it. The Salinas River meanders down the middle.
It's off to our right now. Anywhere where you see sort of taller row of trees is probably where the river is. Yeah, right that far side there.
But most of what you see is mile after mile of fields, some bare, ready for planting, some with rows of green leaves just emerging from brown dirt. This is one of the country's biggest sources of fresh lettuce and spinach. It's often called America's salad bowl. And for the past 40 years, this valley's been the scene of a struggle to find a balance between some of the most intensive farming in the world and what's left of nature. When Daniel Mountjoy first came here as a student, almost 40 years ago, farming had already taken over.
One of my professors brought us out on a field trip.
This professor had invented some of the first chemical herbicides that farmers used to kill off weeds.
He was very proud of the fact that the farmers had been able to eliminate and restrict all non-crop vegetation from the farms, and pointed out that you could tell a good farm from a bad farm by the fact that there was, from fence post to fence post, the only thing that was growing was the crop.
Mountjoy, though, found it bleak. Ecologically, it was impoverished. Barely any food or shelter for insects, or the birds that feed on the insects, or bigger animals that need even more space. Also, when it rained, soil and fertilizer washed straight into drainage ditches, streams, and the Monterey Bay. Daniel Mountjoy became part of a movement to change that. He went to work for the environmental conservation side of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and for almost 20 years, part of his job was encouraging farmers in this valley to create a greener, more diverse landscape. He stops the car to show me an example, a drainage ditch almost 2 miles long. 10 landowners agreed to cover the bare dirt banks of this stream with grass. It held the soil in place and captured fertilizer runoff that would otherwise have polluted the bay.
And so it was a green swath all the way through the valley, and it represented a real advance towards water quality protection.
In other places, farmers took hillsides or the margins of fields and planted vegetation that was specifically selected to be a good home for insects, especially insects that actually help farmers by gobbling up pests like aphids. And there were even visionaries who talked about creating corridors of wildlife habitat across the valley so animals could migrate from the mountains on one side over to mountains on the other. Then, 6 years ago, there was a food safety crisis in the Salinas Valley. Bags of pre-washed spinach from this area killed several people and sent hundreds more to the hospital across the country. The leaves had been contaminated with a deadly kind of E. coli bacteria. Those microbes can be carried into a lettuce or spinach field by wild animals, even little mice that might find shelter in grass along drainage ditches. The leafy greens industry was determined to eliminate that risk, and Mountjoy watched his green swath disappear.
The farmers increasingly were being told this is a potential risk to your operation. And one by one, the growers came in and sprayed it with herbicide knocked out the grasses and returned it back to its bare ditch condition.
It wasn't just this ditch. Across the valley, trees, grass, and hedgerows disappeared. So did ponds that might attract ducks and geese. Farmers built fences along the Salinas River channel to keep wildlife that lived there from crossing into fields. That campaign has been a success in one way. In the last few years, there have not been any more big national outbreaks of disease traced to leafy greens. But many environmentalists and even some vegetable growers here think that this campaign for food safety has also been reckless and sometimes needlessly destructive.
People know me as a fighter. I'm not going to give in to everything.
Bob Martin has grown vegetables here his whole life. He runs Rio Farms near King City. He doesn't call himself an environmentalist, but when food safety experts from the big food buyers told him to clear away vegetation on hillsides, he refused.
It goes against my nature to have the scorched earth policy, to just have bare banks. So every time it rains, you've got to bring the bulldozer in and push that dirt back up. Makes no sense. Erosion control is a healthy thing, and it's necessary.
What really gets him frustrated are demands that seem contradictory or even self-defeating. For instance, he always liked having hawks or owls around because they control the mice. But now he says those birds are seen as a threat, too.
I mean, it's frowned upon to put an owl box. The food safety people, the owls poop, too. Okay, well, but what do they poop? They poop the mouse that you didn't like in your salad. It's everything we do is conflicting. It seems like we can't do anything right.
In fact, even some of the people who came up with the new safety guidelines admit they don't know for sure which of their anti-wildlife rules really do make food safer. Mark Borman, who is president of Taylor Farms, one of the biggest sellers of fresh leafy greens in the country, says they were just the industry's best guess for what to do to prevent a repeat of the great spinach disaster of 2006.
When you're kind of faced with an unknown, which the industry was faced with 6 years ago, you know, you throw everything in the kitchen sink at it, right?
But then you try to get a little smarter, he says. And in fact, industry-funded groups and the government now are doing research, trying to figure out which animals really are a serious threat to food safety and which ones might actually be helpful because, for instance, they prey on mice. That research is not done yet. But Daniel Mountjoy says he thinks the pendulum is already swinging back a little bit. He now works with a nonprofit group called Sustainable Conservation. And he's been meeting with farmers, environmentalists, and regulators. Together, they're looking for creative ways to manage agriculture in the Salinas Valley so that it's safer and also greener.
Environmental protection, food safety, economic profit, you know, all of those have to go together.
So can you have it all?
I think so. I firmly believe so.
In fact, he says, the salad greens industry of the Salinas Valley needs all of that to survive. Dan Charles, NPR News.
Could use Atlanta raise Kobe beef. It's a menu item that increasingly is popping up all over the country. And I have a couple of menus in front of me here in the studio from local restaurants in Washington, D.C. Here are a few choice items. We've got a ground Kobe beef and sirloin burger with smoked mozzarella. That is $10. Here's one from another menu. This is a Kobe beef burger topped with Tillamook and aged white cheddar. $16. Here we go. This is for Kobe steak ravioli with spinach and chestnut pasta. $34. Food writer Larry Olmsted has noticed Kobe beef's growing popularity, but on his Forbes magazine blog recently, he revealed this. If you have ordered Kobe beef in a restaurant in the United States, you were lied to. You did not eat real Kobe beef. So what did you eat?
It's really impossible to say, except you can guarantee that it was not real Kobe beef. Particularly if you get a slider or a burger, you know you're in trouble, because real Kobe beef does not make for good burgers. You're never going to see a Kobe beef burger on a menu in Japan. It's too fatty and too marble. So the only way to make it into a good burger is to mix it with a bunch of American cows and, you know, make it more like American beef.
Okay, so what is Kobe beef? I mean, if it's not what I'm seeing on the menus in restaurants in the U.S., what is it?
Well, it's a particular breed of cow under Japanese law, the Tajima breed, that has to have been born in Hyogo Prefecture, which Kobe is the capital of, raised there, fed a certain diet produced there. They're not, contrary to what a lot of people think, grass-fed beef. They eat some local grasses. They also eat hay and feed, and they have to be slaughtered in Hyogo Prefecture, where none of the slaughterhouses are approved by the USDA for export. So even when Japanese beef wasn't banned as it is now outright, Kobe beef wasn't coming here.
Okay, so I don't get it. How is it possible that this world-renowned beef that is so expensive, you say only 3,000 head of cattle, Kobe cattle, exist in the world. How is it possible that restaurants all over the United States advertise Kobe beef, Kobe beef burgers? I've seen Kobe beef hot dogs. How is that possible?
Well, it's the Kobe beef growers or cattlemen in Japan have both patents and trademarks on the different terminology, Kobe beef, Kobe cattle, none of which are protected under U.S. law. So we can call pretty much anything we want Kobe. You know, really, as the Department of Agriculture cares that when you call something beef, it's beef, and that's about it.
Now, as a food writer, I'm assuming you've eaten Kobe beef.
In Japan.
In Japan, okay. So is Kobe beef, real Kobe beef, better than like a USDA prime ribeye that you can get at, you know, one of these great steakhouses in America?
I personally don't think so, but that's very much a matter of taste. You know, it's like saying, is red wine better than white wine? Its thing is that it's buttery, right? It's really fatty, but it's so marbled. And, you know, most steaks we get, there's meat and there's fat. There's not that much marbling, but the fat is so spread throughout it that there's a little bit of fat in every bite. And as a result, it sort of melts on your tongue. It's very rich. It's very buttery. Yeah, it's a matter of taste. It is very good.
That's Larry Olmsted. He's a blogger for Forbes.com. He writes about travel and food. Larry, thanks.
Thank you.
Now it's time to open up the pages of the Washington Post magazine. That's something we do just about every week for interesting stories about the way we live now. And today we'd like to talk about the way we eat now, at least in the Mid-Atlantic area. Now, if you're from or visit this part of the country, then you probably know Baltimore, Maryland's culinary claim to fame is its succulent blue crabs. But you might not know that locals also love its hometown cookie. It's the burger, a cakey confection capped with a thick dollop of chocolate frosting. For decades, you couldn't find these streets too far outside the city limits. But now, boxes of burgers are popping up on store shelves in and around Washington, D.C. And one Baltimore-born writer is asking whether this dessert is too good for the nation's capital. He's Andrew Reiner. He's a professor at Towson University in Maryland. And his story, Does Washington Deserve the Balmer's Burger Cookies?, was featured in this week's Washington Post magazine. You know, I should say welcome, but the insult is so great that I should challenge you to a duel. You know? So I'll try to contain, but so for people who have never experienced the burger, may not seem like such a big deal. Why is it such a big deal?
You know, it's one of those foods that it's iconic. It's positively iconic. It's like in the piece, you know, I mentioned crab cakes and steamed blue crabs, right? Everybody thinks of that with Baltimore, of course. It's just part of the fabric of the culture there.
Plus, it's so good.
It is.
It's so good.
It is, you know, and it's so interesting because you go into the blogosphere, and what kind of floored me when I was first doing research for this piece was that in the blogosphere, so many people who are writing about this cookie are not from Baltimore, and they don't really even necessarily know people from Baltimore. And as you mentioned, I think, at the outset, is that it's from exclusively, always had been from Baltimore. And yet, it's gotten out there. And a lot of foodies and blogger foodies around the country know about it.
Why is it that this cookie has remained exclusive to Baltimore until now?
You know, I would like to give some really amazing insight and some really profound, some amazingly profound, deep observation. The bottom line is that he just didn't have the money. It's just literally was just plain and simple economics.
They didn't have the money to distribute it or to build a factory. You need like regional factories to make it really the way it is.
Yeah, right. What's really kind of in a way kind of amusing about the whole distribution is that I think there's only about 7 trucks, and they're not really trucks by the standards of what we see in the highway. They're like vans, really. And they're retrofitted with these air conditioning units in the back. And it's because anytime there's warm weather, if they don't have those, you show up with those cookies and it's just this sloggy chocolate mess. So it's a matter of having the money to be able to have the trucks that in the warm weather can go to other cities.
So it's kind of like a locavore's delicacy.
It is. It's just it's so interesting because it has been so tied to the weather.
We're talking about the rise and reach of burger cookies. Our guest is Andrew Reiner. His story, Does Washington Deserve the Balmer Burger Cookies, was featured in this week's Washington Post magazine. Talk about the birthplace of the burgers, the factory where they're made.
It's in this small, it was an X factory, and it's in a very small space in a part of Baltimore called Cherry Hill that is a very unlikely place. Cherry Hill has been a very poor area where there's a lot of poverty and all the things that you just would assume would go along with that. And you don't expect to find industry there. Burger, the bakery, is not as nearly as large as I thought it was going to be. You know, they had found this space, which I thought was really kind of a stroke of good luck for everybody, through the Baltimore Development Corporation. And they found this place for Charles DeBalfre, who's the owner of the bakery, over in Cherry Hill, which I thought was really a great thing.
So why don't you think the people of Washington specifically don't deserve these cookies?
It's, you know...
And I'm keeping this little box right here on my side of the table.
And as we hear the cellophane opening,
yes. Them opening, and I'm checking out the little cake. You just ponder why you think we don't deserve these while I open these cookies side of the table.
I will weigh these words
and
carefully.
I'm just looking at this beautiful bit of cake. I can't even describe it. It's kind of like half a moon pie, only it's vanilla cake with a ginormous dollop of chocolate, the best part. So I'm waving it at you. Tell me again why Washingtonians don't deserve these.
This is the inspiration I need. It's, you know, I'll tell you, can I give you just a little bit of backstory on this,
sure.
Michelle? Okay. I moved down to the D.C. metro area last June. And if you ask my wife, she would quickly tell you that it was not an easy transition for me. So I'm walking around a giant food store and I see the burger cookies. And my first thought, of course, is, oh, wow, you know, being like an expat in a foreign city, I'm thinking, oh, wow, great, one of my compadres here. But then a part of me is kind of taken aback. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, is this really such a good thing? So I get the email address for the people at Burgers, and I email the owner, and I said, why are they down here? You know, there was a part of me, I have to admit, there was a part of me that was slightly incredulous.
You think this is more of a truffle oil town.
Yes,
right?
Exactly, right. Exactly. So I'm thinking, you know, can these folks down here really appreciate the burger cookie? And so he says to me, well, you know, it strictly, of course, was a financial thing. And I'm thinking, okay, great, I totally get that.
Well, but now that you've been here a while, how you feel? Are you kind of getting used to the idea that maybe we too can enjoy some burgers?
Not yet. Not yet. I'm not there yet.
Hater. Andrew Reiner is a professor at Towson University. That's just outside of Baltimore, Maryland. His story, Does Washington Deserve the Balmer Burger Cookie, was featured in this week's Washington Post magazine. And he was kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios, where I may let him have a cookie. Andrew, thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.